This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for special Earth Day programming on KBOO. As Kate mentioned, we are airing environmental public affairs programs all day today until 7. At that time, we will go to Sounds from the Natural World, produced by the Different Nature Collective, and that will continue all night long until 7 a.m. tomorrow, and I recommend tuning in for that. It's wonderful with no human sounds for those 12 hours. All of today's programming honors Earth Day, and our guest in this segment has honored Earth Day by writing a history of it. Adam Rome is the author of the new book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Adam Rome teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. His first book was The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism. Adam Rome, welcome to KBOO Radio.
Well, thanks a lot, Kathleen. It's great to be on, and also to have Marvin Gaye welcome me on.
Yeah, it sort of goes back to that era. Tell us what prompted you to tell this story of Earth Day.
I wanted to write about environmental issues in a way that allowed me to tell a story, and Earth Day, because it was an event, seemed like a real possibility, even though I never really thought much about it. Before, I lectured on it, but I hadn't really tried to understand just exactly what it was. And it turned out to be much, much more interesting, much, much more inspiring than I expected when I set out to write about it. It wasn't just a good story.
Uh-huh. And what do you think about it? It impressed you as being so much more interesting than what you had thought?
I didn't really realize, first of all, how many thousands and thousands of people were involved in organizing Earth Day. The idea came from a U.S. senator, which is amazing in and of itself, that a 50-year-old balding figure of the establishment could start what became the greatest demonstration in American history, with millions and millions participating everywhere in the country. But part of Nelson's genius was that he didn't try to tell local organizers what to do. He didn't tell them what kind of event Earth Day would be. He left it up to them. And I was amazed to find how many thousands of people spent months, very intense months. It was, you know, one said it was a three-month adrenaline high working on Earth Day, making it happen. And then many, many, many of them ended up being inspired to continue to work on environmental cause after Earth Day. And many of them had no interest in environmental issues before. They just thought it was a good cause, something that would be a good use of their time. But their lives were changed by it, and I never expected that.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we should talk a little about the time prior to the first Earth Day and what were some of the things that were having an impact on American politics and culture that basically laid the groundwork for this to happen. And, you know, I was interested that you talked about people like John Kenneth Galbraith and others as sort of this liberalism that was present at the time that was part of that background. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Although there was no environmental movement that before 1970, no one even used that phrase before the run-up to Earth Day, people had been increasingly concerned about a variety of different problems: air pollution, water pollution, mounting garbage, the loss of open space, a big issue in Oregon at that time. But those were all fragmented. They weren't part of one movement. And so what became the environmental movement, what literally came together on Earth Day, was many different strands of activism. And there were scientists, housewives concerned about the ways in which this struck home, young people, both countercultural folks and radsters, some of the old conservation groups. But as you mentioned, liberals really were important, and Gaylord Nelson himself was a liberal. Liberals had tried since the Great Depression of the 30s to ensure that everyone had enough of the basic necessities of life. As that goal came closer to being accomplished, they began to think about ways in which the quality of our lives wasn't as great as it could be, and what government could do to make a greater quality of life for Americans. So Galbraith, in this famous book, The Affluent Society, the symbol of how disgustingly imbalanced our life was. We had all these great private goods, but our public spaces, our rivers, our parks, our schools were nowhere near as great. And he really helped make that an issue, as did other liberals, thinking about what government could do to improve quality of life.
And what were before Earth Day, what were the conservation groups of that time like compared to the groups that we know of today?
There really were very few. The only group with an environmental name was the Environmental Defense Fund, which was only 3 years old in 1970, and it was just a bunch of lawyers and scientists. Their lead lawyer, Victoriana Cohn's slogan was "Sue the Bastards," but they had no members. The Natural Resource Defense Council was only formed 1 month before Earth Day. So the older organizations were the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, and they were mostly interested in wilderness areas, in national parks, and in wildlife, especially the kind of game that hunters went after or fish. They weren't at all interested for much of their history up until 1970 in things like air pollution or river pollution. The other urban issues that then became part of the environmental agenda. So they'd been slowly beginning to become more environmental in the 60s, but it wasn't until after Earth Day or right before Earth Day that groups like the Sierra Club began to broaden their focus to realize that the challenges were much greater than wilderness and wildlife.
So Senator Gaylord Nelson made this announcement in Seattle, which seems like an odd place, or seemed like an odd place at the time, to have made this announcement about Earth Day. Tell us about that.
Well, he'd been trying for the whole decade. He became senator in 63. He'd begun to work on environmental issues, especially open space and water pollution, as governor of Wisconsin. He tried and failed to get the president to make this a national issue. He convinced the president, John Kennedy, to take a conservation tour of the country, but it was a bust. The top-down effort to create a movement didn't work. He introduced legislation in the 60s to deal with pesticides, which was a growing concern thanks to Rachel Carson's great book, Silent Spring, to deal with the death of the Great Lakes. And nothing happened until he had this idea for a teach-in after coming back from seeing the devastated beaches of Santa Barbara after the oil spill there. He announced it, as you said, in Seattle in September. He'd been invited out there by the state's leading conservation organization, which was trying to get a ban on the pesticide DDC, and he'd been in favor of that. And at the time, Seattle was not yet the trend-setting home of Microsoft or grunge rock or Starbucks. So it was an odd place. It was 3,000 miles away from the media centers of the country or from the political center. And luckily, though, it was reported. And then the idea took off. Within a month, it was getting national attention. Nelson worked hard to promote this idea of a teach-in, and that became Earth Day. And he had help as it became overwhelming, the amount of interest across the country. His staff couldn't handle it. He hired a group of 20-something activists, one of whom now runs a foundation based in Seattle, the Bullet Foundation, Dennis Hayes, to help coordinate it. But ultimately, it was people all over the country deciding this was a good idea. They wanted to make Earth Day happen. They wanted to make a teach-in happen that made it so successful.
And you write in the book, and again, I am speaking with Adam Rome, and the title of his new book is The Genius of Earth Day. You write in that book that there was a difference in the way this teach-in and Gaylord Nelson promoting this teach-in and how that happened compared to other big events of the day and how they happened, other big protest events such as the March on Washington in 63. Talk more about how it was different.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it was fascinating to me to start thinking about what made Earth Day even more successful than the most famous civil rights and anti-Vietnam War demonstrations of the 60s. So the March on Washington, which led to Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech, that was organized by just a handful of civil rights organizations with the help of the Kennedy administration. So it was very top-down, and it was only in one place. The anti-war demonstrations at the end of the decade were the opposite. Virtually no one who was powerful was involved. It was just some activists who organized at the grassroots and got a couple thousand of events with maybe a couple million participants. But what made Earth Day remarkable and unique was that it combined all the power that someone like Gaylord Nelson had, the power to get money, to get media attention, to attract talented people to his staff, with the energy and creativity of thousands and thousands of local organizers who came to own Earth Day. They made Earth Day what they wanted it to be. And that combination, bringing together both the power of the top-down establishment and the creativity and energy of the grassroots, was unbeatable. It really was remarkable.
And how big was Earth Day when it happened? When you talked about thousands or more people, talk about it in terms of other demonstrations, other mass gatherings, and what its total numbers were.
So the March on Washington was maybe 250,000 people. And there was only one Earth Day event that had that many people in one place, which was in New York City. They closed down Fifth Avenue, and a quarter of a million people went onto the streets to celebrate Earth Day. The anti-war moratorium events of 1969 might have gotten 2 million people scattered across the country in many, many different demonstrations. Earth Day, at the time, people estimated 20 million participated. Virtually every college, 1,500 colleges, virtually every K-12 school, 10,000 of them, and hundreds of communities had Earth Day events. Some of them were bust, but some of them were just astonishingly successful. They drew tens of thousands of people, and they had a lasting impact, which I think also was unusual, that the way Earth Day was organized helped allow it to leave a lasting legacy. But the size of it really made a big difference. Because there had been nothing like it, the media took notice. The Today Show dedicated its entire week that week, 10 hours of broadcasting, which it had never done, to the environmental issue. Congress closed on April 22nd because so many members of Congress were going to be speaking, two-thirds of them, around the country at Earth Day events. By my estimate, at least 35,000 people spoke at Earth Day events. I think that's a conservative estimate. And that's really astonishing that there were only a handful of environmental experts, but Earth Day proved that a lot more people really had something to say about the issues.
And you actually highlight a number of the speakers from the events of that day, which included scientists and religious leaders and the economist Kenneth Boulding and the West Coast fledgling feminist Stephanie Mills, legal experts. Talk about the importance of these speeches and how they sort of spawned movements afterwards.
And again, the sheer variety of the kind of people, as you say, that spoke on Earth Day really surprised me. It wasn't just professors or students. It included virtually every kind of person, business leaders, labor leaders. A lot of religious leaders gave sermons on the Saturday or Sunday of that week. Activists, you name it. Earth Day brought out speakers. And even those who had spoken before about environmental issues were challenged by the day. They'd never faced as big crowds. They'd never had to talk to as wide-ranging an array of people. The ecologist Barry Commoner spoke to 15,000 people in the basketball arena at the University of Michigan. And so many people speaking on Earth Day were speaking for the first time. Just thinking about what they wanted to say was radicalizing, was transformative for some of them. They realized they cared about this more than they thought, that it touched them more deeply, and they were going to have to speak about it in some unaccustomed ways if they'd spoken before, or they'd were going to speak about it for the first time in ways that really showed how much they cared. That was really, I think, astonishing there was a profound debate that Earth Day set off, an unprecedented debate about why we had environmental problems and what we could do to solve them, how How much did we have to change in order to solve them? People had wildly different ideas about that, but the New York Times described one of these teachings as soul-searching, and I think that was an apt description of many of them, that whether you were speaking or just listening, this was engaging in a way that people found fresh and exciting and ultimately transformative.
And so maybe now we should talk as much as we can about the legacy of Earth Day. And I would like to get your opinion on what you think the most important aspect of the legacy of Earth Day is, of the first Earth Day in 1970.
I think there were two different kinds of legacies, and one people already knew about before. One, I think, is really something that I, even as an expert in this area, had no idea about. So the one that I think was more obvious was, as Gaylord Nelson hoped, Earth Day did impress politicians, and it led to one major piece of national legislation after another: the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. And it also led to the Environmental Protection Agency, and states created environmental protection agencies. So the most obvious legacy of Earth Day was, for the first time, a major national commitment and also a commitment by many states to make the environment better, to protect the environment. The legacy that really I didn't appreciate myself before I started to work on the book was more institutional and more individual. That a lot of the people that worked on Earth Day or participated in it ended up going on to create new environmental organizations, or they went to staff these new environmental agencies, or they wrote books about the environment, or they became environmental journalists or environmental architects or environmental lawyers, or they started community ecology centers, which often were the first places that did any recycling, which was unheard of at the time. Now we take it for granted. Or they created environmental studies programs in colleges or environmental education courses in high schools and junior highs. So out of Earth Day came what I call a new eco-infrastructure that helped to make sure that even after people forgot Earth Day, or even after the press was no longer reporting as much about these issues, that the concern would continue. And the press, by the way, I should have added, before Earth Day there were only a couple of environmental reporters for newspapers. The television networks didn't have environmental reporters. Within 5 months of Earth Day, more than 100 newspapers had environmental reporters. So it helped to institutionalize environmental coverage in the media in a way that also obviously helped ensure that these issues didn't just fade away, that they became things people continued to think about.
Mm-hmm. And one very direct group that was an outgrowth was, as you mentioned, Dennis Hayes, one of the people that Gaylord Nelson enlisted. His group, Environmental Action, was a direct result of that.
And it was a new kind of a group. Because of the tax laws at the time, the older groups, the older conservation groups, had never lobbied. If they lobbied, they would lose their tax-exempt status. And the 20-somethings, led by Dennis Hayes, who formed Environmental Action, decided they didn't care about tax-exempt status. What was more important, to be able to lobby and to endorse candidates. And they, in 1970, they picked out 12 incumbents in Congress who they thought had particularly bad records on the environment. They called them the Dirty Dozen, and they worked to defeat them, and they defeated 7 out of 12. They also lobbied on the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and on other environmental issues. And so that led to a new institutional presence in D.C. for environmentalists, and Environmental Action also could mobilize all the local organizers who had been part of Earth Day. That was one of their greatest achievements, essentially, was creating a Rolodex. It was before computers, before social media. They had this unbelievable Rolodex of you know, 10,000 people who were involved in local Earth Day organizing efforts and who could then put pressure on Congress, put pressure on the president to do things. And that was new.
Adam Rome, in the postscript to your book, The Genius of Earth Day, you compare the Earth Day, the original Earth Day celebration of 1970, with the 1990 celebration. And you say that the 1991 was less successful, and you pose some reasons for that. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, 1990 was the only other time that anyone made an effort to organize Earth Day nationally. After 1970, individual communities could decide to do it or not. But in 1990, there was this big push, much better equipped. It had all kinds of super high-level media and other consultants involved. It had a huge budget, over $3 million, big staff. And they did succeed in some of their goals. They got big crowds in big cities, even bigger than the first Earth Day. But where I thought they fell short was, I didn't think that the Earth Day 1990 celebration really encouraged that kind of soul-searching, which I think is the heart of real activism. People only change when they've learned something that forces them to reconsider what they've thought. The first Earth Day did that. I don't think the 1990 Earth Day did it. The 1990 Earth Day was much more about making small, conspicuous gestures that indicated you cared about the environment. The first Earth Day, I think, led many, many more people really to change their lives. And I end the book, before the postscript, I end the book with four people. I could have picked any number of others whose whole life course was changed by Earth Day. The 1990 event, I don't think, did that nearly as much, partly because sequels are always tougher to do well than the original, but partly because I think the 1990 organizers didn't appreciate the power of the educational process that the original Earth Day really was, that people really thought deeply and reflected deeply in 1970 and ended up deciding they wanted to make a difference. So they had to figure out for themselves how to make a difference. By 1990, they could sort of plug in. They could go to work for the National Resource Defense Council, or they could go to work for the EPA. In 1970, they really had to figure out their own career path if they wanted to make a difference. And that creativity turned out to be really powerful. A lot of people did really interesting, exciting things as a result.
Mm-hmm. And it's difficult sometimes when a movement has been that established to try to find a way into that same kind of soul searching that you're talking about.
I think you're right, and I'm a historian, not an activist, but I hope that people will read the book and be inspired to think about what you'd have to do today to do just what you just said, Kathleen, to bring some of that energy and freshness back, that outside-the-box thinking that the first Earth Day had and that has become harder to have as the movements become more institutionalized, easier to dismiss as a special interest, and so on.
Well, Adam Rome, I know you have to go. You probably have many engagements on Earth Day. So we want to thank you for being with us today and wish you the best. Thank you, Adam Rome.
Well, thanks so much, Kathleen. And if I could give a shout-out, I was a journalist for a while, and my first boss lives in Portland now, George Naval. So, George, I hope you're listening. Portland's a great city, and I'm delighted to have been on the radio with you, Kathleen, today.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too. And I will let people know that you've been listening to special programming for Earth Day on KBOO Portland. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest has been Adam Rome, author of the new book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Adam Rome teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. And special Earth Day public affairs programs continue through the day until 7, and then we go to All Natural Sounds for 12 hours from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. If you'd like to hear the show again, you can go to kboo.fm and look at the schedule for today. And as we complete the programs for the day, each segment will be available on the website. Stay tuned for Joe Meyer and an update on the move to fluoridate Portland's water supply. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.
Animals and birds who live nearby are nice. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they do.
to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more will be from man? Can't you stand?
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of the 23rd annual Reach the Beach, scheduled for Saturday, May 18th. With the finish line in Pacific City, Reach the Beach offers four different starting locations. You can ride 100 miles from Portland, 80 from Newburgh, 55 from Amity, or 28 miles from Grand Ronde. More information on deadlines and registration for Reach the Beach can be found on our website at kboo.fm.
Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Author and radio show host Tom Hartman is referring to a growing movement in this country to pass a 28th Amendment to the Constitution. On Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m., Hartman returns to Portland to speak on We the People, not We the Corporations. That's at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th Avenue and Main Street. He will also be speaking in Salem on Saturday, April 27th at 1 p.m. at the Grand Theater on Northeast High Street. You can refer to the KBOO Community Events page for more information or firstunitarian.org.
Portland, Oregon is the largest U.S. city not adding fluoridating chemicals to their public water supply, and Portland voters have already rejected this proposition three times, most recently in 1980. The effort to add these chemicals to our Bull Run water picked up again in the summer of 2011 when the nonprofit Upstream Public Health teamed up with rock star political consultant Mark Weiner. The plan seems to have been for Mr. Weiner to work his magic on the Portland City Council, while Upstream Public Health recruited supporters among local nonprofits, especially those serving communities of color. The Oregonian broke this story in August of 2012, and citizens began to organize in opposition. Here are voices from the August 21st rally outside of City Hall.
Cavities correlate with poverty, not fluoride. It's the only thing you can link to increased cavities. And we know we have increased poverty, hungry children in Oregon, so let's spend that $5 million feeding them instead of putting a toxic chemical into the water and dumping it into the river.
Why are we spending money to put some chemical into our water for health purposes? Don't we have problems with more depression in this part of the country than others? Hey, why don't we put antidepressants in the water? Hey, I know. Let's put vitamins in the water. Aspirin. What about anticoagulants to stop people from having strokes? Aren't those all a lot more important than things we do for cavities, maybe, where there's nothing proven to work?
In spite of this public opposition and cries of public water, public vote, the pro-fluoride strategy seemed to pay off. Upstream Public Health signed up over 50 local groups, including the Latino Network, NEA, the Center for Intercultural Organization, and the Urban League, while winning Mark Weiner met with all five city commissioners. This led to a 5-0 September 12th Portland City Council vote to add the fluoridating chemicals. Immediately after this vote, the group Clean Water Portland announced that it would challenge the decision with a citizen referendum. And indeed, that group collected over 40,000 signatures in less than a month, successfully referring the measure to voters. This vote was originally scheduled to take place in May of 2014. However, in one of Randy Leonard's last acts as Portland City Commissioner, council voted 3-1 to call fluoridation an emergency and move the vote up to May of 2013. Nick Fish joined the lame ducks Adams and Leonard on the yay side. Fritz voted nay, and Saltzman had a prior commitment. Here's Randy Leonard explaining his support.
Do Portlanders want fluoride in their drinking water?
I think that they do. Again, I'm not a scientist, but, you know, I can read scientific documents. Centers for Disease Control said fluoridation of public water systems was one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. And every leading medical organization, the American Medical Association, the American Pediatric Association, has said this unquestionably advances health, particularly for poor kids, particularly kids of color. And to me, it's an equity issue and it's a public health issue.
With such a short time frame for the referendum vote, information was fast and sometimes furious, with several local organizations hosting debates. Here are Drs. Philip Wu and Rick North after their presentations to the East Side Democrats.
Dr. Wu, why is this such a controversial issue?
You know, it's not just a controversy here. It's been a controversy everywhere. And I think for some of us, it's hard to understand what the basis of that controversy is when, from our perspective, the science is extremely clear about the safety and effectiveness of fluoride. So I think in a lot of debates, you know, you will hear issues of regulation and of, you know, choice and things like that. You know, those are not issues of medicine or science or so. They're a political issue. And so I think to a certain extent that may drive some of the controversy.
Leaving the effects of fluoride alone for a second, what about arsenic? We know there's arsenic in these chemicals, and we know that's not good for us.
There's no concern about fluoride somehow aggravating or elevating or making worse any issues around arsenic.
But there's arsenic in the chemicals we're going to put in our water. We'll be ingesting arsenic.
Not as part of fluoride, no.
But as part of the chemicals we're putting in there.
No.
Okay. Last question. Would you recommend formula made with tap water after we put fluoride?
It is considered to be completely okay to give infants formula with tap water.
Okay. Great. Anything else for our
And the American Academy of Pediatrics